This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Maintaining bone strength is complex with no single solution. My patients who want to optimize their bone health have seen remarkable results with LiveMD as part of a comprehensive bone program. LiveMD is a Class 1 medical device cleared by the FDA. It creates a gentle, low-intensity vibration to benefit your musculoskeletal system. It's a safe, scientifically proven, and simple approach to maintaining musculoskeletal health and wellness. It really works, just 10 minutes per day. Go to livemd.us, that's livemd.us, to learn more about how LiveMD may improve your health. That's livemd.us. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about something very timely and very fundamental. It's the debate about whether we should eat meat. And this debate's been going hot and heavy for decades. And recently, we've been regaled with headlines that once again suggest that eating meat may be as harmful to us as smoking cigarettes. A steak is the new cigarette. That's the contention of some of the lurid headlines. Today we're going to talk to an expert. She's been a frequent visitor here on Intelligent Medicine. Nina Teicholz is an investigative journalist, and she's author of the International New York Times bestseller, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And it's really been a blockbuster. It's been named a best book by The Wall Street Journal, The Economist, Forbes, Mother Jones. And it has created a great impact because it's upended the conventional wisdom on dietary fat. And Nina has been a real force challenging our current nutrition policy. She may have the distinction of being the first non-MD to create a huge ruckus in the pages of the British Medical Journal recently, challenging the dietary guidelines for America. Dietary guidelines are set by the government, and there's a lot of criticism of the way these guidelines get set. We're going to talk a little bit about that. She has a master's degree from Oxford University, and she served as associate director of the Center for Globalization and Sustainable Development at Columbia University, my alma mater. And she lives in New York City. Nina, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And congratulations on the success of the book. You really messaged beautifully in the book. Just give us a little background because, you know, you are not an MD. You're not a PhD, food scientist. But you devoted a considerable amount of time as an investigative journalist looking at the facts behind our nutrition policy, correct?
I did. I spent almost a decade researching nutrition science and the politics and the history and the personalities and the players. And so I don't have a formal degree, but you know what I always say is that this is a field where the PhDs, you know, it's mainly the PhDs that do the research. I mean, I'm sorry, no offense to your profession, but the doctors really don't study nutrition much. I think they get like a day in medical school. So it's just a field where the PhDs have gotten it wrong. In a number of key ways for three generations now, believing that fat is bad for health, dietary cholesterol is bad for health, and you know those measures have basically been reversed. So it's an area where there is a need and a room for outsiders, I think, to contribute in this area.
Well, you know, these big questions, you know, like should we drink alcohol? Should we drink coffee? Should we exercise at high intensity or is low intensity enough? These questions are always controversial. It seems to me that these very questions, which are so germane to our life decisions, like should we eat meat, should we be vegetarians, they're so prone to scientific error, controversy, and outright bias, aren't they?
Well, I mean, The main source of flip-flopping headlines is a kind of weak science called epidemiology, which shows associations but can't prove causation. I mean, anybody from like your elementary science class knows the difference between association and causation. Epidemiology shows associations, but they can't prove cause and effect. Only clinical trials can do that. So often what we read in newspapers, and the reason there's so much flip-flopping, is that we read about an association, but when it's actually tested in a clinical trial, it doesn't turn out to be right. So like a lighthearted, funny example of that recently is making sure you ate breakfast. That was recommended as official policy. You had to eat breakfast in order to maintain your weight. But then they did an experiment, an actual clinical trial, and they fed people oatmeal for breakfast or frosted flakes for breakfast, or they told them to skip breakfast, and the only people who lost weight were the people who skipped breakfast. Well, there's a whole science about why that might be true, but that reversed that headline, and then people are confused, and then our official advice sort of loses its credibility, and it's because for the most part, the reversed guidelines, like on dietary cholesterol, another one that has been reversed recently, don't eat egg yolks. Now we can eat egg yolks. That's all because those original recommendations were based on this kind of weak science called epidemiology. So, and there are other factors why we have been stuck kind of in these this kind of paradigm about what makes a healthy diet that may not actually be true. And, you know, that does have to do with bias, this sense that there's a need to defend long-standing advice, three generations of professionals and experts who believe this advice, and the difficulty of backing out of that. So it's what I call professional bias, so the institutional bias as well. You know, institutions don't want to back out on this advice either. So there are just a number of factors. I mean, we didn't even get into the influence of the food corporations, but, you know, there are a number of factors why we're sort of stuck in this advice that clearly isn't making people any healthier.
Well, the latest challenge to the notion that meat is okay comes from a big study that suggests that red meat, and not just processed meat, they're even implicating non-processed red meat, you know, lean cuts of beef may actually be harmful or dangerous. It's gotten a lot of play. It's all over the press. And what say ye in relationship to this, Nina?
This is the IARC, which is a division of WHO. It's an international organization that's supposed to determine whether or not things cause cancer. I think they've looked at 300 different substances over the course of their institutional life, of only one of which didn't cause cancer. So, you know, the bias is for finding things cause cancer. And I think that the headline here is that, again, this is based on epidemiological evidence. So when you determine if something causes cancer, you look at animal models. That data was deemed to be inadequate. You look at mechanistic evidence to see, like, well, you know, are there possible mechanisms for causing cancer? That was conflicting. And what really drove this decision, and I've talked to people now who've been on that panel, I've talked to three or four people in the room, several people on the panel, and what drove the decision was, again, epidemiological data based on very, very weak associations, tiny associations, which they could be right, but they're equally likely to be wrong. And in this case, it's particularly surprising because there were actually big randomized controlled clinical trials, the kind of evidence that can show cause and effect. One called the Women's Health Initiative on nearly 49,000 women lasting 8 years. The other one called the Polyp Prevention Trial, lasting a multi-center trial. Both of these are NIH-funded. The second one was on 2,000 people lasting, I think, 4 years. Both of those successfully reduced meat in the Women's Health Initiative by 20%, and they didn't find any reduction in cancer of any kind that they measured. So that's the kind of evidence that should prevail, which is to say, we tested it. It's not a perfect trial, but it's definitely does not show an indication that meat causes cancer. And so the thing about the way the IARC works is they don't look at human clinical trials, because most of what they're looking at in for cancer is, you know, like arsenic. You can't test it in clinical trials because it's a toxin. So they don't really have a mechanism for looking at clinical trials. So, you know, I think that this decision is questionable, and again, it's just very what history has shown us is that it's very dangerous to issue public health advice based on this epidemiological data with very, very weak associations, and you know, it's just a shame. I mean, it's going to take years maybe to reverse this.
Well, you know, I think a classic example of an epidemiological trial or study is the China study, which is often invoked. You know, I often have arguments with dyed-in-the-wool vegetarians, and they say, "Look, the book it's a doorstop. It's like, you know, 600 pages of scientific documentation that shows that in China, when people ate a quasi-vegetarian diet, there was less cancer, there was less heart disease, and now." With changes in the diet, or compared to European countries, where they could, you know, so it's a classic example of an epidemiological study that's used to invoke this argument. But what are the problems with that? I mean, you know, clearly we're talking about an underdeveloped country, a country where there was maybe less pollution in the past, now more pollution, and they certainly are catching up to us in industrialization.
You know, these kinds of epidemiological studies, it's just that they can only, as I said, they could just only show associations. So, and you really, so just to give you an example of like, okay, so let's say you come up with an association. People with yellow fingers get lung cancer. And that may be an extremely strong association, but is it the yellow finger or is it the fact that smokers get yellow fingers because they're holding their cigarettes? Like, you cannot say anything for sure because of the issues of confounding. Maybe it's something, you know, you really just don't know what is the factor that is causing the effect that you're seeing. Here's another example. The main study that was used to prove that saturated fats cause heart disease is from the 1950s. And they looked at a bunch of populations and they thought that the reduced saturated fat eating is what saved people from heart disease. But here's the thing, they also measured, but they weren't that interested in, or they didn't think that this was, you know, it wasn't the kind of the factor they were looking at, and that was sugar consumption. Sugar consumption was extremely low in the countries where people didn't get heart disease. So was it the saturated fat? Was it the sugar? Was it something else they maybe didn't measure, like the amount of magnesium in the soil or their exposure to car exhaust? I mean, you just don't know in these kinds of studies. That's why they're supposed to suggest hypotheses, and then you're supposed to, what you're supposed to do in science is then test the hypotheses. That's what you do in a clinical trial, where you can actually control the factor that you're trying to test.
Is it possible that, you know, this is the World Health Organization, there's a big, you know, I live literally two blocks from the UN, and I know that the UN is currently a hotbed of a discussion about climate. And, you know, call it what you will, climate change, global warming, conserving resources, low carbon footprint. Is it possible that they're confounding the argument for let's save the planet with let's reduce beef consumption or meat consumption? Because the supposition is that this is wasteful of resources. It generates whatever, methane, it's high energy agricultural production, and it's damaging to our ecology.
I think that what has happened is that there has been an assumption in the community of sort of influential people in nutrition, which journalists, chefs, people, and nutrition scientists, that meat is bad for health, and so there's now kind of this added fuel for that argument that it comes from the environmental movement. We all feel passionately about saving our planet, and there is a great deal of fear, legitimately, that exists out there about how are we going to feed our growing, burgeoning population and save the Earth. But how to save the Earth is a separate scientific question from what should people eat to be healthy. You cannot merge those. You just have to, you know, honestly treat those as separate issues. It is not.
Because in effect, what they're saying is they're saying, well, you know, maybe we're right, maybe we're not right about this meat being bad. But in any case, it's good to reduce meat because of the ecological arguments. I think that sort of weighs in the favor.
Right.
You know, it's like even if the argument's a little shaky, we might as well reduce our dependency on meat because it's bad for, you know, the environment.
It's bad for the planet.
Right.
So why, you know, and it seems like such a neatly tied up argument to say, okay, what's good for the planet is also good for us. You can do good, feel good, be good. All of that can be fused into one triumvirate of goodness. And it would be great if that were true. But we have to be, and if our current, you know, movement towards a more plant-based diet were producing good health in America, I think that we could say, well, this is working, so let's add on to this other agenda that we also hope to serve. But, you know, the evidence is clear that reduced meat consumption, we've reduced meat by 17%, red meat by 17% over the last 30 years, and beef particularly has declined by 22%. So we have reduced meat, and that does not seem to be part of the formula which has improved health. I mean, we're clearly getting fatter and sicker. That's not to say that reduced red meat consumption has caused that, but we don't seem to be on the right path. So, and another data point to consider is that cattle stocks have declined by 30% over the last 30 years. So are they causing global warming? It's not clear. And that particular data point doesn't seem to support that hypothesis. And if it's true that a pound of health, plants is equally healthy as a pound of meat, that would be great. And then we should choose the pound of plants, maybe, or if that turns out to be better for the environment. But there's a lot of data to show that that is not true. You can't get a complete protein from plants. Humans mm-hmm. need complete proteins. You can't get the same kind of nutrition from a pound of plants. You can't absorb it. It's not as bioavailable. You need something like 62 cups of spinach to get the same amount of calcium as you can from like a small piece of cheese. So it's not clear that that's the route to better health. And that needs to be debated as a separate scientific question before we merge all these separate agendas into one.
And it's
in
also
my opinion.
Right, right. And you know, it is all, you know, it's all subject to some degree of controversy. You know, there's also some argument to be made that, you know, when you get those fresh blackberries from Costa Rica in the month of January in New York, that while that seems like a preferable vegetarian alternative to a sirloin steak, that takes an extraordinary amount of water, of fuel, energy in transportation, flying it to an airport in North America and then transporting it via highways to a market, refrigerating it, and so on, that too places a burden on the environment. That, you know, sometimes what seems to be eco-friendly may ultimately not be so eco-friendly.
Yeah, I mean, these are, you know, to really evaluate this requires very, you know, complex formulas. I mean, you know, there was recently a decision, but, you know, the Dietary Guideline Committee in the United States tried to evaluate, these are nutrition experts trying to evaluate sustainability, and, you know, and there were a number of people who said, you know, we shouldn't have nutrition experts trying to weigh all the environmental factors. They're not experts in this. And, you know, I think that's, and it's not within their mandate, and, you know, which I think is legitimate. It's not in their mandate, and these are really complex issues that environmentalists need to address. I mean, as you say, where does anybody in the Northern Hemisphere think their fruits and vegetables are coming from in Whole Foods in, you know, from October through June? Those are all transported from various, you know, more temperate climates. And all of that requires fuel, and, you know, I mean, and so it's just, if we think that's the most healthy historical diet, where do people historically in those climates get those foods? They didn't have, you know, refrigerator cars and trucks to get them from the tropics. So how do those people avoid obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, which clearly they did? You know, they're relatively recent diseases. So, you know, some of this just flies in the face of common sense and an understanding of history.
So what about the Dietary Guidelines for America? You and other people have taken issue with the dietary guidelines, and most recently created a big brouhaha on the pages of the British Medical Journal. You wrote a letter, which, you know, I find it surprising because I read, you know, these medical journals, and seldom does a, well, I won't call you a layperson. You're a very informed investigative journalist with a master's degree. But, you know, usually these are nutrition scholars and medical doctors who get into it about this. And yet your article generated a lot of blowback.
Well, so the British Medical Journal does publish feature articles by journalists. So that's not so uncommon, and I'm a journalist, and that's why I did that article. But it did, it was a very highly controversial article. It was a very rigorous attempt to look at the advisory committee report for the dietary guidelines. You know, dietary guidelines are issued once every 5 years by the USDA and HHS, and there is an expert committee that is appointed. This year it was 14 people that is supposed to review all the science, and then they write up a report. That report was published in February of this year, and I spent months going through it to try to really understand the science and see the rigor behind it. And what I found was disturbing, which is that in the majority of cases where they were supposed to use to do kind of systematic scientific literature reviews, they didn't. They didn't use their own internal system for doing these systematic reviews, and instead they didn't do that for whatever reason, but they were usually on really key issues about which there's debate. Like, you know, there are two really obvious ones. One is saturated fats. There's been a ton of rethinking about saturated fats over the last 5 years. Many review papers, meta-analyses, systematic reviews looking at saturated fats and really challenging whether or not they actually cause heart disease. And those papers were not systematically reviewed. A number of them were omitted by the Dietary Guideline Committee. The other topic is low carbohydrate diets. Also a tremendous amount of literature, more than 70 clinical trials alone, not to mention other kinds of papers on that diet, showing that it is, if, you know, at the very least, safe and sustainable and a very good option for treating obesity and diabetes. And preventing those diseases, and if not better than a low-fat diet. And the committee did not systematically review that literature and just didn't review it at all. I said they couldn't find it. So, and there are just a number of other problems with that report. It's confusing and contradictory. There are recommendations that are not supported by the studies that they cite. They omit important studies. And, you know, overall, the impression that you get is that there is an attempt to going back to this question of bias, there's an attempt to preserve existing recommendations, not to change them, not even if there's new challenging science, not to change. And so there's just questions about bias, about is there bias at work here to preserve 35 years of government advice? And it wouldn't be such an urgent or important question. I certainly wouldn't stick my finger into this, like, hornet's nest if Americans were looking remotely healthier. But, you know, the obesity epidemic really mm-hmm. took off the very first year in 1980. That was the first year that the dietary guidelines were issued.
We're having a health crisis and an economic crisis around this because, you know, our healthcare system, ever more costly, ever more high tech, and yet we're not getting bang for our buck.
Yeah, even though we all now wear watches that chart our every footstep and every calorie, it's not working. So we have to take a hard look at what has gone wrong. And I think that's legitimate, even though I've received a lot of blowback from that. I mean, and it's not just me. I mean, there is now a really sizable, substantial literature, scientific literature out there, including by former Dietary Guideline Committee members themselves saying, this isn't working. We have, you know, our advice is erroneous. Our process is not working. We're not reviewing the literature, just, you know, in a way that is rigorous. I mean, there's widespread concern about all these issues. And, you know, it's an urgent question, I think, for Americans.
It is indeed. And this is a good point at which to pause, because we divide these podcasts into two parts. And in part two, I want to issue a call to action, because there is a movement afoot, and you're part of that. You support it, to challenge the dietary guidelines, because we're reformulating them this year. And we need the input of concerned citizens. And I know we have a lot of health professionals who listen to this podcast, and we want to enlist you to be part of that initiative. We'll talk about that in part two, and we'll also talk about some of the evidence that is in Nina Teitel's book, which is called A Big Fat Surprise. Some new data that suggests that, hey, maybe we took a huge wrong turn in recommending the ultra-low-fat, high-carb diet. Our guest is Nina Teitel. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.